Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, your local connection to the world on WSCA, LPFM, Portsmouth Community Radio. This is Steve Diamond, here to introduce our show to you today, October 29th, 2005. Thanks for joining us. Today, we'll be taking a closer look at Afghanistan and the historical roots of its current situation. We'll be speaking with two members of Rubia, a local group working to improve the economic conditions of people in Afghanistan. We'll also have a few commentaries and political music. But first, this news. And now, we have some underreported, condensed news stories from this past week that you may have missed. Indictment doesn't clear up mystery at heart of CIA leak probe, from Knight Rider. At the heart of Friday's indictment of a top White House aide remain two unsolved mysteries. Who forged the documents that claimed Saddam Hussein was seeking uranium for nuclear weapons in the African country of Niger? How did a version of the tale get into President Bush's 2003 State of the Union address, even though U.S. intelligence agencies never confirmed it? Former Ambassador Joseph Wilson, who found no substance to the alleged deal during a CIA-sponsored trip to Niger, accused Bush in July 2003 of twisting the intelligence. Shortly thereafter, the identity of Wilson's wife, Valerie Plame, a covert CIA agent, was leaked to journalists, igniting Special Counsel Patrick J. Fitzgerald's probe. The FBI has been investigating the clumsy forgeries, which first surfaced in Rome in October 2002, for 2 years, but has made little progress, four U.S. government officials said. These officials blame a lack of cooperation from Italy. A spokesman for the Italian embassy in Washington denied that. But a weeks-long review by Knight Rider has established that Italy's military intelligence agency, SISMI, and people close to it repeatedly tried to shop the bogus Niger uranium story to governments in France, Britain, and the United States. That created the illusion that multiple sources were confirming the story. The CIA had begun receiving intelligence reports based on the same forgeries in October 2001, but they had not been confirmed. Copies of the fake documents suddenly surfaced at a critical point in the White House's fall 2002 campaign to take the country to war in Iraq. The CIA eventually determined that the earlier reports were based on the forged documents and were thus unreliable, a Presidential Commission on Unconventional Weapons Proliferation said in March. State Department intelligence analysts and some in the CIA discounted the uranium story. But White House officials, working through a back channel to one CIA agent, seized on the tale and it was included in Bush's case for war. On October 5th, the CIA wrote the White House that, quote, "the evidence of the uranium ore deal is weak. One of the two mines cited by the source of the uranium oxide is flooded. The other mine cited by the source is under the control of the French." There are some indications that the Italian government may have been the source of the forged documents. Italy is a close U.S. ally in the war in Iraq. On March 3rd, the International Atomic Energy Agency told the United States that the documents were forgeries after an expert used the Google search engine to identify false information. And next from the Associated Press, ExxonMobil posts new records for profit. ExxonMobil Corporation had a quarter for the record books. The world's largest publicly traded oil company said Thursday high oil and natural gas prices helped its third quarter profits surge almost 75% to $9.92 billion, the largest quarterly profit for a U.S. company ever, and it was the first to ring up more than $100 billion in quarterly sales. Revenue grew up from $76 billion in the prior period. Howard Silverblatt, equity analyst at Standard & Poor's, said both the net income and sales figures are all-time records for publicly traded U.S. companies. And from Agence France-Presse, mother of slain U.S. soldier arrested in Iraq war protest. U.S. police arrested Cindy Sheehan, the mother of a U.S. soldier killed in Iraq who has been a prominent war opponent, along with 24 other people for demonstrating without authorization in front of the White House. Sheehan and the other protesters staged a die-in in front of the White House, lying on the ground to symbolize U.S. soldiers killed in Iraq. Several dozen sympathizers applauded as Sheehan and others were taken away. Lieutenant Phil Beck of the U.S. Park Service said, "Cindy Sheehan has been arrested with about 25 other people because she was demonstrating without a permit in front of the White House. Most of them will probably be released tonight. They face a $75 fine." Sheehan became an icon of the anti-war movement when she camped outside President George W. Bush's ranch in Texas during his August vacation, demanding he meet with her. She had called Tuesday for civil disobedience around the country to demand the withdrawal of the 140,000 U.S. troops from Iraq as the U.S. military death toll hit 2,000. On Wednesday, she said in a statement, "There comes a time when we have to break a small law, like sitting down in front of the White House, in order to point out a greater law that's been broken. I can't imagine a greater law that's been broken than a war being waged in our name, whose justifications have proven to be false, and yet goes on anyway, taking the lives of thousands of people," she said. And from Knight Rider, Americans' anger may threaten GOP control of Congress. Americans have turned so sour about the state of the country and their lives that Republican strategists fear they could rise in a wave of anger and sweep Republicans out of power in Congress in next year's elections, much like they swept the Democrats out in 1994. Voters haven't yet turned to the Democrats as a viable alternative, but their anxiety about Iraq, the economy, gasoline prices, and the overall performance of the federal government has even some Republican strategists fearing the November 2006 elections. Frank Luntz, a Republican strategist who helped his party capture Congress in 1994, said, "As angry and pissed off as we were in 1994 about politics, I think it's worse today. This House of Representatives' Republican majority is in jeopardy." Republican pollster Ed Goes said, "Today, President Bush and our Republicans face a political environment that, as reflected in current polling numbers, is the most negative environment of his presidency. Beyond that, Bush and Republican lawmakers are hindered in their ability to wage a political comeback. They're torn by internal fights over Bush's nomination of Harriet Myers to the Supreme Court and soaring federal spending. And they face a litany of woes beyond their control, among them a criminal investigation into White House leaks of a CIA officer's name, a U.S. death toll in Iraq that passed the 2,000 mark Tuesday, and a coming surge in winter home heating costs. That leaves Bush in a tough spot. Any time he turns to those issues, he reminds people of things that make them nervous, not happy." A new bipartisan poll released Tuesday underscored the problems Republicans face 1 year from midterm elections, when they must defend their slim majority in the Senate and House. The survey was conducted jointly by Goes, who works for Republican congressional candidates, and Democratic pollster Celinda Lake. It was sponsored by George Washington University. The poll found that 66% of Americans believe the country is on the wrong track, while 28% said it was headed in the right direction. It found 44% approve of the way Bush is handling his job, while 54% disapprove. A key reason for his low standing? 58% of voters said the federal government did a poor job responding to Hurricane Katrina. Voters also signaled different ideas about how to pay for rebuilding after Hurricane Katrina. While Republicans in Congress debate how much to cut spending, 73% of voters said they would cut spending on highways that do not go directly to road work, 68% said they would raise taxes on those making more than $200,000 a year, and 63% said they would start withdrawing U.S. troops from Iraq and pull out all by the end of next year. F. Christopher Arterton, dean of George Washington University's Graduate School of Political Management, said, "It is difficult to believe how much the battleground of public opinion has changed in 11 months. After the 2004 election, Bush and the Republicans stood virtually unchallenged in the center of the ring. Now they're on the ropes, from self-inflicted blows." Goes said, "This does not mean that Democrats are soaring with newfound respect from the voters. They have done little to project themselves as having the solutions to the nation's problems." And from the Boston Globe, Blix says U.S. misled itself, the world, on Iraq. Bush administration officials misled themselves on weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and then they misled the world, Hans Blix, the former United Nations chief weapons inspector, said. Speaking at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, Blix criticized the administration's actions before invading Iraq in March 2003, but stopped short of saying it intentionally fooled the public on the existence of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. "I've never maintained that the Bush administration deliberately misled the public," said Blix, who headed the inspection team before the U.S.-led military action in Iraq. "I think they misled themselves, that we can see, and then they misled the world." Asked at a press conference later what he meant, Blix said the administration interpreted satellite pictures and Iraqi defectors' information as evidence that weapons existed in Iraq, when that information was, in his opinion, inconclusive. "They took things they saw as conclusive," he said. "They were not critically thinking. They wanted to come to these conclusions." On Iran, Blix said he doesn't think referring Iran to the UN Security Council would succeed in pressuring Iran to reach an agreement to restrict its nuclear program. Instead, Blix said, European countries need to sit down with Iran and offer it assurances like the ones North Korea is getting. And from the Boston Globe, grieving families find little peace. There are 2,000 of them now. 2,000 Purple Hearts. 2,000 knocks on the door. 2,000 flags folded smartly into triangles. And as the toll of U.S. military deaths in Iraq reached the 2,000 mark, six of the families who cherish those symbols, medals and ribbons and tokens of condolence, say they are resolved to preserve the legacy and memory of the men and women who died in a war that most Americans, polls say, have turned against. In Westbrook, Maine, a little boy, just 2 when his father was killed, suddenly looks up from his plate of spaghetti and Parmesan cheese and asks his mother, "How did Daddy die?" In North Kingstown, Rhode Island, 2 mothers wonder why they still scan an internet list of the victims of the war. "We don't want to see our sons there," Donna August finally concludes. who want to wake up from a bad dream. In Albany, Vermont, where Marine Sergeant Jesse Strong's Purple Heart sits atop a dresser in his boyhood bedroom, his parents gaze outside his window to rolling green hayfields and recalls the bright-eyed boy who used to stare through binoculars at deer in the distance and at the stars in the midnight sky. He didn't even want to kill a deer, Vicky Strong says of her son. He just would go out in the woods. The family is interviewed by the Globe, one from each New England state, voice a range of feelings about the war, bewilderment, anger, acceptance, pride. But they agree that the public's growing antipathy for the war concerns them less than their sense that this conflict has become, for many of their neighbors and countrymen, an abstraction, its casualties obscured by worries closer to home, the monster storms, the rising fuel prices, the exigencies of everyday life. A war fought by volunteers in a strange, far-off place seems, they say, especially hard for the nation to keep in mind. "That's the worst fear," says August, whose son Matthew was killed in Iraq last year. "If you ask all 2,000 families, that's the thing that you fear the most, that your son died in vain." When specialist Jeremy Regnier, 22, died outside Baghdad on October 13, 2004, he fell into the arms of Sergeant Andrew M. Wilson, his superior officer. The armored vehicle they rode in was rocked by a roadside bomb. "We turned a corner and it just went black," Wilson recalled. "I didn't know what the hell happened. I'm talking to Jeremy at the same time. I'm like, 'What the hell was that, dude? Hey, what do you see? What do you see?' I didn't realize it until I slapped him to see if he was all right, that he was gone." 2 days before the first anniversary of that mortal attack, Staff Sergeant Wilson, retired and suffering from post-traumatic stress, sat at the dining room table in Littleton with Regnier's parents and tried to make sense of this war. He can't. "When you have Iraqis, whose job it is to get up in the morning, kiss their kids, have their breakfast, and go blow themselves up, I don't know how to fight that," said Wilson. "That's why I'm here and not there anymore." Kevin Regnier supports the troops but doesn't understand the war either. He has come to believe that the assault on Baghdad was driven by the president's desire to finish a job that his father, the first President Bush, began in 1991. "He's a warmonger," Regnier said of the current president. "If we must do this, then why isn't he sending any of his family? Why aren't the politicians' families over there?"
When you can't believe a word they say, and you're haunted by the swords they raise, like a rabid dog we've seen before, they refuse to hear the world pounding down their door. We don't want your war. Let's all yell a little louder now. We don't want your war. All stand together tall. We don't want your war. You keep telling us, you keep telling us we do. The king has no clothes, so he leads by fear. We must challenge all the lies we hear. The devil's bombs has an oily smell, frames a legacy with infamy. He burns it into hell. We don't want your war. So yell a little louder now. We don't want your war. All stand together tall. We don't want your war. You keep telling us, you keep telling us we do.
on a million graves. Will we all be proud, or will we be ashamed of our leadership? Greedy and arrogant, and we'll all be judged by the choices that we made.
We don't want your war.
It's all singing louder now.
We don't want your war.
Telling us we do.
We don't want your war.
Don't stand together, yeah.
We don't want your war.
All stand together tall.
We don't want your war.
So stop telling us. Stop telling us we do. www.jinx.com.
J-Y-N-K-Z. Jinx.
That song was the new classic, if that's possible, We Don't Want Your War. Next, we have a few commentaries from the alternative media.
This is Voices of Our World. I'm your host, Eileen Bott. President Theodore Roosevelt said, "To announce that there must be no criticism of the president, or that we are to stand by the president, right or wrong, is not only unpatriotic and servile, but is morally treasonable to the American public." That's not what we've got right now. When the Army Corps of Engineers top procurement official, Bunnatine Greenhouse, objected to continuing to hand no-bid long-term contracts to Halliburton without annual review, she lost her job. When Army General Eric Shinseki warned Congress that the Bush administration grossly underestimated the manpower needed to control Iraq, well, that's the last public comment anyone heard from him. Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill and counterterrorism advisor Richard Clark spoke out well before any of us ever heard the Downing Street memo, saying the administration was fixed on trumping up justification for their war agenda, and they swiftly joined the unemployed. Four weapons of mass destruction investigators in succession, Scott Ritter, Dr. David Kaye, Charles Dulfer, and Nobel Peace Prize winner Mohammed El-Baradei, all had their reputations smeared when they agreed there were no WMD. And of course, when former Ambassador Joe Wilson reported that Iraq had not tried to purchase uranium from Niger, somebody in the inner sanctum thought it might be a kick to expose the identity of his covert CIA agent wife. On the other hand, despite Bunnatine's ethics, Vice President Dick Cheney's Halliburton stock options rose 3,281% since the start of the war. The affable former Undersecretary for Arms Control, John Bolton, got the top U.S. post at the United Nations, even after stating that it'd be just fine if the top 10 floors blew up. The CIA's George failed to connect the dots, Tenet, and J. Paul, $8 million missing from the Iraqi treasury, Bremer, both got the Medal of Freedom. Michael, doing a heck of a job, Brownie, Brown, 3 days after he lost his FEMA job for incompetence, got rehired by FEMA to investigate what went wrong. Now the president wants his personal lawyer, who served as a Texas lottery executive, to be appointed to the Supreme Court. Maybe it's high time we stopped putting the ultra-rich and their scions into office. Maybe we should be sending people to Washington who, like us, are having trouble paying for health care, their kids' college tuition, and gasoline. Let's go back to sending Mr. or Mrs. Smith to Washington by making sure they can afford to run for office.
The problem isn't just Judith Miller. This is Geoff Parrish. As I record this, the country's political class waits with bated breath for possible indictments from Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald. But But one of the more fascinating subplots to this week's Capitol Hill Death Watch has been the sudden public ferocity with which colleagues and bosses have turned on New York Times reporter Judith Miller. Miller is the Times reporter who spent 85 days in jail this summer before reluctantly testifying to Fitzgerald's grand jury about the details of two meetings with Scooter Libby, Vice President Dick Cheney's chief of staff. The details of her testimony could be key in indicting Libby, particularly the revelation that Libby dropped the name of CIA agent Valerie Plame weeks before her husband, former Ambassador Joseph Wilson, went public with his criticisms of the Bush administration. Miller went to extraordinary lengths to protect Scooter Libby and his boss, but that should come as no surprise. Prior to her jail stint, she was best known for a series of front-page articles in the New York Times during the run-up to the invasion, all painting lurid pictures of Iraq's non-existent chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons programs, all based on the testimony of various Iraqi exiles and senior White House officials with axes to grind, all completely fictitious. Now, Miller's bosses are charging that she never came clean with them about her meetings with Libby, and her abrasive personality, the sort of personality a woman isn't supposed to have, has resentful colleagues coming out of the woodwork now that she's down. But the real beef of her journalistic brethren, 2 years after the fact, seems to be that, as she admits, Miller got the story seriously, completely wrong. Maureen Dowd, in a Savage syndicated column this past weekend, sniffed that investigative journalism isn't stenography. But it's not investigative journalism that gets you lucrative gigs at prestigious outfits like the New York Times. The Times, the Washington Post, and a very small handful of other media outlets are the stenographers of choice for America's power elite. Because so many other wire services and media outlets base stories on what these papers publish, the result is that America's mainstream media is suffused with credulous accounts of public policy, accounts often planted without either attribution or accountability for political purposes. Don't believe it? Look at the coverage this week of Fitzgerald's probe. With little to do but speculate, endless stories advancing the minutiae of the case have spun forth, almost all of them based alternatively on senior administration officials or lawyers close to the case. Without any knowledge as to who is saying what and why, a curious public is left with a bunch of competing noise, not knowing who to believe. The result of this sort of coverage? Eventually, people just tune out. Miller's got to be a little bit mystified as to why all this fuss over her service to power. After all, that's what she was good at, and it's exactly why she was hired and then promoted for 28 years as a star reporter. She didn't get to her position at the New York Times by accident. It took a lot of stenography, a lot of reporting that pleased the people that matter. That's how you cultivate sources, and that's how they give you more stories, in every sense of the word. Miller's transgression wasn't that she got the story wrong, it was that she and her editors misled the public. That's a far graver sin, and a more common one. By leaving out or de-emphasizing vital information, by only quoting one side, by failing to provide context, presumably unbiased media stories all too frequently adhere to the objective truth, in the sense of not telling any whoppers, while still misleading the audience. It may be too much to hope for that these elite media organs will absorb the lessons of Miller's mistakes and reform themselves, but the lesson should be clear for such papers' readers. The disease of Judith Miller is the disease of American media itself. Let the reader beware. From JBCS, for the Pacifica Network, this is Joff Parrish.
Hi, I'm Jody Paulson with What They Don't Tell You. As I speak, President Bush is in big trouble. His approval rating is below 40%, and more Americans want to see him impeached than wanted Bill Clinton impeached on the eve of his actual impeachment. As the Bush White House continues to become embroiled in scandal, chaos, and paranoia, it's tempting to compare this administration with that of Nixon. And by my yardstick, Bush far outdoes Nixon in terms of nastiness, vindictiveness, arrogance, heck, anything but intelligence. Of course, I can't claim any recollection of the details of Nixon's presidency as they actually occurred, though I'm sure it impressed my toddler's psyche with a lifelong distrust of the government. But correct me if I'm wrong, Nixon's real downfall was his paranoia. Watergate was about bugging and stealing from the Democratic National Convention. Bush's Waterloo, on the other hand, has to do with his administration's proclivity to smear and kick around anyone who gets in their way. So when Joseph Wilson started criticizing Bush's claim that Saddam Hussein was seeking uranium from Niger to make nuclear weapons, suddenly a bunch of reporters hear about his undercover CIA wife, and Robert Novak actually writes about it. So, whereas Nixon kept a secret enemies list, Bush's enemies are as visible as Saturday morning roadkill. Just look for the smear. Nixon was sneaky and subtle enough to earn the nickname Tricky Dick. For the Bush-era Republicans, however, I'd say the watchword is hubris. What word better describes these words from now-indicted former House Majority Leader Tom DeLay? When told that smoking on government property was against federal regulations, DeLay responded, "I am the federal government." However, as self-professed born-again Christians DeLay and George W. Bush ought to know, the Bible says pride goeth before a fall. And if history's any indication, the neoconservatives who have infested our government have a very long way to fall indeed. I'm Jody Paulson, and I just thought you should know.
To listen to archive editions of What They Don't Tell You, go to radio.indymedia.org or www.radioforall.net.
Don't think twice about the life you lead. Must be nice that someone else will bleed. Fear is all around, terror's on the rise. Stars and stripes are waving, fills our patriotic hearts with pride. Don't think twice. Don't think twice about the wars we wage. Don't compromise. No, that's a big mistake. Freedom's on the march. God is on our side. Sure to say a prayer for those courageous souls we sacrifice. Don't think twice. Think twice about the lives we take. Wrong or right, it's got to be our way. So that we may live, thousands have to die. Say the pledge and tell yourself that we will surely justify. Don't think twice. Don't think twice. It isn't up to you. Close your mind. Pretend it's just not true. These colors never run. We're not afraid to fight. Especially if someone else is gonna have to pay the price. Don't think twice. Don't think twice. Don't think twice. Don't think twice.
That was the John Casper Band with Don't Think Twice. Next we have an interview with local members of the group Rubia, working to support Afghan women, helping them to support themselves.
For Making Waves, I'm Tom Jackson, and I'm talking with the folks from Rubia, which is an organization that works in both Afghanistan and in Portsmouth. We're talking with Rachel Lair and Jeannie Fries. And let's start off with talking about what it is that that Rubia does.
Rubia works in Afghanistan, has worked there for a couple of years now with women in the countryside and in the capital city of Kabul, providing income and education in a land that is devastated by war and drought.
Okay, and Rachel, you were just there recently in Afghanistan, sorry.
Yeah, I just came back at the beginning of September. I was there for part of the summer. I was working on helping with the training that we were doing. We recently trained 200 women in the countryside to do sort of advanced embroidery, training them how to work, how to take instruction, how to do fine work, working with the materials that we use there, setting up a literacy project for the women that we work with. Part of what we do in Afghanistan, too, is look for marketing for our materials, selling our work both in Kabul to the foreign community there and finding the marketing venues outside of Afghanistan. For instance, we sell quite a bit of the work that the women do here in the United States, in particular in New Hampshire.
So you actually see some parts of Afghanistan firsthand. That, I mean, not that there are hundreds of people from the U.S. going over visiting Afghanistan, but generally speaking, most folks from the States who go there are pretty much confined to Kabul, and you go out to other parts of it and see it. Where in Afghanistan are you going to?
You're right. Not only am I not confined to Kabul, but I travel with Afghans and live with Afghans, which I don't know any other Americans who do. And we're working in an area called Dar-e-Noor. It's a valley called Dar-e-Noor, which means Valley of Light. It's outside Jalalabad. It takes about 3 hours from Kabul, going east to Jalalabad, 3-4 hours by road, depending on the conditions, and then another hour or so to get up into the valley north, into the mountains. And that road is only about 20 miles distance, but it's such bad condition that it takes a long time to get there. So I'm really lucky. I speak Afghan Dari. It's a language I studied back in college and have been able to pick up again, and have really done all the work I do using that language.
Have you ever had an experience? I mean, that you're talking about an area of Afghanistan that most people from the United States would probably not want to go to, because it's known to be a rather dangerous area. Have you ever felt afraid while you were there?
I've never felt really afraid in Afghanistan. And for a lot of the foreign workers, the American workers who are there, they would love to be able to get out and get into some of those areas, but they're not allowed to. Their security is such that they're kept from leaving the embassy compound or the place that they work. Most of the foreign aid workers work in an office. They have a driver that takes them home, and then they go back to the office in the morning. They're not allowed these days even to walk around the streets of Kabul. My experience is the complete opposite. I don't get to work in a nice office, and I don't have that kind of nice driver, but I do get to go wherever I want to. I am on the listserv for, or it's a list that comes out from the U.S. Embassy, the warden's list, that tells you the dangers every week, and it'll tell you who's been kidnapped last week or who was almost kidnapped. And for the last couple weeks, there's been this warning that goes out that says, Americans should not be on the Kabul-Jalalabad road because there is there's known to be a vehicle-borne improvised explosive device. It says VBIED, and then it explains vehicle-borne improvised explosive device along the road there. And in fact, the most recent one said, this vehicle will be parked at a gas station. The hood might be up. It might look like somebody is checking the oil. I couldn't believe this one. Like, we're supposed to be looking out for these things, but best of all, just don't go on that road. And most foreigners don't go on that road. They'll fly back and forth. But I travel that road, and I just don't. I wear burqa when I'm traveling in Afghanistan so that people don't recognize me as a foreigner. And I guess we won't be stopping any gas stations sometime soon.
Make sure you got a full tank before you head out.
I mean, it's so bizarre. You gotta see these warnings. They're just bizarre.
Well, I've seen some of the work that the women in Afghanistan do, and it's absolutely beautiful. Jeannie, as you're an upholsterer here in town, and you have sort of a special relationship with Rubia. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, when I traveled over a couple of years ago to Kabul, I met with one of the women and we developed a business relationship where she does one-of-a-kind pieces for me to put specifically on one-of-a-kind pieces of furniture. So I sell those, and also we raffle them off as fundraisers for the organization. But that's a separate business, and what I'll do is donate about 10% back to Rubia and then pay Hafiza directly for her product.
Okay, and while we're on the subject, where can we find the Rubia products here in New Hampshire?
We are selling at European Home right now. They've opened up part of their store through the month of October for all of our product. So we have our full line displayed there. And we also have a chair and a tote bag being raffled for a fundraiser. European Home is behind the Portsmouth Herald, and it is on Vaughan Street.
We also have a show coming up starting in on November 4th. We have a show opening up at Little River Oriental Rugs on Main Street in Concord, right at the heart of downtown Concord, and that show will run through the month of November featuring our whole line of products.
Does Rubia have a website, and can you give us the address for that?
Rubia has a website. It's rubiahandwork.org. Some of the current information is on there. We'd love to have people volunteer. We have a wish list. So anybody interested in helping us with our website or graphic design or some technical issues, design issues, we have lots of people have come to us asking how they can help us. People have given us sewing needles and threads and yarns and fabric. What else have people given us? Clothing that we have sent to Afghanistan. All kinds of things should be listed on our website. You know, one of the things I think that's interesting is that here we are in rural New Hampshire, and Afghanistan, for the most part, even in the city of Kabul, is pretty much a rural country. And there's that connection of rural to rural, of being concerned about people who are tied to their land and connected to their land in a way that we can appreciate in New Hampshire. And developing not only as a larger organization and business relationships, but also individual relationships. For example, Jeannie, taking the risk of going to Afghanistan and meeting a woman there and developing a business relationship is fabulous. And other artists have come to us and said, I'd like to do some design piece for you. And working with people directly in Afghanistan, it keeps coming up. And I think it's a strong New Hampshire-Afghanistan connection.
Rachel, one of the things that seems to always come up in terms of, you know, when we talk about Afghanistan, even in the now post-Taliban era, is relationships between men and women. You know, there's the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan that have done a lot of really brave work in Afghanistan for many, many years. They were kind of a focal point in the media prior to the U.S. invading Afghanistan and helping to oust the Taliban. But now we don't really hear from them so much, and it's not because they're not there, they're still there and doing great work. But there's almost a sense, and I was told this by some very prominent women in Afghanistan when I was there in 2004, there's almost a sense that from the Afghan perspective, people in the United States just think that everything's just fine now with, you know, with women and how they're treated in Afghanistan and those kind of things. What are you seeing when you're there?
I think the initial stories that came out after the fall of the Taliban was these images of women tearing off their burqas and going out in public, and it made a big splash, but it's not representative of what life was like in Afghanistan or is like now. So many people say to me when they see the burqa that I have, oh, women are still wearing burqas, because they remember them taking them off. The burqa's been a part of Afghan life for a long time. It's an old tradition of theirs. It's not part of every tribal group. The tribal group that we work with, it is their tradition, and women continue to wear the burqa. It's that burqa is perhaps representative of the relationships between men and women that certainly we don't expect to change in a short amount of time. In general, in Afghanistan, men don't respect the women very well. In general, people are poorly educated. I don't know what the statistics are, but it's something like 90 to 95% of women are illiterate. So sometimes we're thinking about the women from Rawa, we're thinking about the 5% in there, and that the women we work with are perhaps more representative. And so their opportunity to work is a first step in gaining perhaps some more respect within their family and more independence. They have some money that they've earned and that they are part of the decision making and how it's going to be spent. So, for instance, the women who I work with, that we work with in Rubia, have a lot of issues about whether they can be photographed or not. And I'm a photographer. Of course, I love to photograph the women there. They're very happy to be photographed, and I have a really wonderful body of work that really is beneath the veil in terms of what I've been able to see, but I can't exhibit that easily. So recently, I wanted to photograph the women with their embroidery and asked if I could photograph them with their burqas on, because that way their faces not being seen won't bring shame to their family. That's the way it works in Afghanistan. So my recent photos are of women in their burqas standing there holding their embroidery. And the statement is quite strong, I think, a stronger statement than maybe seeing who they are, but knowing that there's a woman behind there and that this embroidery is representative of who she is, and she signs her name on her embroidery. It's part of making a statement about herself, but yet you still can't see her. When we first started our project, we wanted to bring both literacy and income to the women. And we started this project 5 years ago in Pakistan with a group of refugees, Afghan refugees. It was before 9/11, and we had no notion that we would ever come back to Afghanistan. And when we first started, we thought, we should get these women going to school. They should start taking classes and learn to read and write and embroider. And we found pretty early on that we couldn't force anybody to do that. We could offer them the hook, but we couldn't, of the embroidery to bring them in, but that we couldn't force anybody to go to classes. So we offered both opportunities. And one of the emblems of what we were doing is to have women sign their name in stitchery on all the embroidery they did, and in their language, which is a very beautiful cursive script that, 99% can't read here in the United States. So it looks very pretty, but it helps us identify who's done what work, and it's, for most of the women we've worked with, the first time they've ever written their name. So it's a big step for them as well. And in Afghanistan, most people don't have last names. Women in particular don't have last names. So just putting that first name out there is a big deal. And as it turns out, after several years of doing this, there was some objection to women putting their names on their work. Some men said, this is shameful for us that our women's names. It's been our mission has always been to tread very lightly on the culture, which means we don't come into an area and say, all right, all the ladies, come on over here, we're gonna get you this or that. We're very patient. We take our time. We want to make a difference in their lives, but we want those differences to come about slowly so that they are real and meaningful.
I think a large portion of the U.S. side of things too is to educate the people in the U.S. too, to make them understand that all of the issues aren't so black and white, that they're different shades of gray depending on what the cultural background is.
Very ancient, very complex culture and tradition. You're right, Jeannie. And we give slide and video lecture presentations. We will talk to anybody about Afghanistan. We're delighted that The Kite Runner is such a big bestseller, because every library in the country, it seems, is having a reading group around The Kite Runner. And so people keep asking us, is that what it's like? Or did he do a good job? Is it true? Or I've been invited to speak at several libraries about Afghanistan. So all of those things are, we don't want Afghanistan to fall off the page. It's sort of fallen off a little bit, and things are not hunky-dory.
It's mm-hmm. And it's all about gradual change.
It's all about gentle, really, right? Well. Gentle. Mm-hmm. You have to be patient. People working in development don't have that luxury in a way. They've got to make big changes fast. They've got a lot of money that's got to be spent quickly. They build buildings, they build roads. They don't really care if those roads or buildings are there in a year or two or three. We come from a different place. We come from a place where we're going to be around for a long time working with this community, and we want the change to really make a difference.
Jeannie, had you been to any sort of, very poor country prior to going to Afghanistan, and really, I guess, whether you had or not, what, can you talk about your impressions just sort of some of the basic impressions that you had while you were there in terms of what you were seeing and...
Actually, I could have my own show about that. But no, I hadn't traveled to any country that was a third world country. I had been to Western Europe and traveled quite a bit, but I had never experienced anything like Afghanistan before. But there is something about the country that makes you want to go back. It's actually a beautiful country, as you know, from your travels. But I went with a little trepidation, but once I got there, it everything became relative. Even safety issues seemed not quite so... Something that might be frightening here just became kind of nothing over there. It was everything in perspective.
People do describe, I've heard aid workers describe Afghanistan as addictive. It's one of those places that if you've been to, it grabs you in a way and holds on to you. And have you experienced that yourself?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, so Jeannie really took a big step and and it's holding
Not only the land, but the people too.
Yeah, there's just something about it.
Hospitality is such a big, you know, that's their claim to fame.
Mm-hmm. And they do it well, don't they?
Yeah, they sure do, yeah.
Even if they have nothing but, you know, a little bread and water, they know how to make you feel like you're really, really just what they've been waiting for all day.
Well, and I think that's what I took away that impressed me most was just how much we have and how much opportunity we have here that we take for granted sometimes. And you know, I'm grateful for what I have, and I always have been grateful, but since coming back, I don't take it for granted. Every day, I feel very fortunate to have what I have, and it may sound a little bit corny, but it's true. And just having the freedom to, you know, be a woman, to have a business of my own, and be able to walk around town by myself.
Up in your car, go somewhere, all those bits of independence that...
Yeah. Things that we really take for granted. And having a car of my own and being able to pick up and go whenever I want to. And it's everything about the country is different, but great. It was a great experience. The food was different. It was much more limited, but, you know, you sit down and they make you a lunch of anything and everything that they have available to them, which might not be a lot, but it's a great meal. And, you know, it's very community oriented, very tribal society.
But when you think about the security that they might feel, or I think about children's self-esteem, or the security of having your family around you all the time and feeling, you know, very safe in that, considering it's a pretty hostile world out there in Afghanistan, that I kind of admire what I see there in mm-hmm. terms of the family units.
Yeah, and they're there for each other. It's a very supportive family unit, extended family unit. You know, if you think of all the turmoil they've had and all the men that have died in the past wars, you know, the families are there, that they take care of each other.
Yeah, never any question about taking care of each other, bringing extra people into their household. It's aunts and uncles and grandparents and cousins, and it's all the same. It's all the same there. They don't have nursing homes in Afghanistan. And I don't know if you remember, but one of the first reports when the U.S. started bombing Afghanistan was about bombing a nursing home in Herat. That was one of the first news reports, and I thought, now something's really wrong here, because there's no such thing. That's my first indication that maybe, you know, we weren't getting it right.
Rachel Lair and Jeannie Fries, thanks a lot for being with us on Making Waves today.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
To hear our previous shows, please visit our archive online, www.freewebs.com/sprav/audio.htm. Please email nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com and let us know what you think of our show. And feel free to call the station in the next hour for more information, 430-9722.